Hello and welcome to Houston Tea After Hours. I'm your host as always, Edward Jones, and joining me, of course, is my co-host, Miss Kim Lum.
Hello.
Tonight, we revisit one of our most favoured traditions here on Movies and Tea, and that is, of course, Shark Week, with a film that can be essentially listed as being the shark movie that started it all. The one that launched a thousand imitators and all of them failing to ever meet the same standard left by this film. We are, of course, talking about Steven Spielberg's classic film, Jaws, from way back in 78, I want to say.
75.
For those of you who may not be aware of what Jaws is, I don't know, I don't question your film taste. Jaws is based on the Peter Benchley best-selling book of the same name, in which the quiet vacation town of Amity Island finds itself under siege when a ginormous man-eating shark moves into the local area and starts preying on the locals, leading small-town Sheriff Brody to step up to deal with the shark problem while the mayor is busy trying to cover up the issue because of the impending tourist season, while local fisherman Quint sees it as a chance for redemption to quash some old ghosts. So, Kim, with Jaws, was this like the first shark movie you saw, or was this like somewhere down the long line of shark movies that you've seen over the years?
Well, I've already said what my first shark movie was. My first shark movie was Deep Blue Sea.
Of course, yes.
Yeah, so that was like way in the beginning. but no, I mean, I watched Jaws in recent years. I think it was maybe a few years ago. I actually realized I never reviewed the movie. I actually reviewed it on another podcast. Had a discussion piece over there, and then I never actually did the write-up for it, but I have the write-up for all the sequels, so I don't know, maybe it's time to make up for some lost time.
Yeah, I mean, certainly with Jaws, it's not only a creature feature or a shark movie, whichever category you just prefer to sort of lump it in. I mean, this is a movie which launched essentially the summer blockbuster, and this was completely by accident, as originally it was set for a Christmas release. But the delays in film production sort of being put into the summer season. And back in 75, the summer season was seen as like, you know, the dumping ground for all the bad movies. Because, you know, they assumed people wanted to be outside and not like cooped up in cinemas. And Jaws essentially comes along and changes all this. And Spielberg leads in many ways this sort of like charge of the new Hollywood. So people like Lucas, Scorsese are like coming in and they just completely change what the summer blockbuster movie is, and it all starts with a movie featuring a giant plastic shark of all things. But for myself, I mean, Jaws is a movie that still sticks with me. It's the reason I'm not particularly fond of swimming in the ocean, which is a real kicker when you live in Cornwall, which is surrounded on three sides by ocean, and all there is to do in the summer is to go to the beach. So there's something about when you look at Amity Island that just like really resonated with my sort of psyche. It's sort of like Amity Island is very similar to the sort of small coastal towns I was like growing up and spending all my time in. So it was just like this perfect storm of like childhood scarring horror that all came together in this just this movie, which is, I think, as close to perfect as you can get. Not to like give the game away, but I think by now, I think you all have your opinions on Jaws, and it's now probably why we put it off for so long. But now we're obviously talking about, you know, the big one that is Jaws. So,
yeah, I mean, Jaws is definitely overdue over here for sure. I mean, it's such an obvious choice to start with that sometimes I feel like we could, you know, right now we're at the bottom of the barrel. So we kind of have no actual choice but to eventually have to embrace this. So I don't know. I mean, Jaws it's hard to argue that it's a bad movie. I don't know how many people out there are arguing that it's a bad movie.
My wife wasn't impressed. She still doesn't understand why a giant plastic shark is scary. So I showed it to her. It's like, oh, you know, this is like this fantastic movie. There's all this great dialogue and character and stuff, and she's like, it's just a giant plastic shark, this isn't scary, this is stupid. And I was like, they just went off and sulked, and it's like, no, it's not.
Well, I mean, it's you know, to each their own, right? Yeah. But I mean, Jaws is not just a creature feature, and in many ways it's so much more than that, because it has that kind of adventure type of feeling. And it was these kind of like different type of parallels that you see in different movies that are trying to be something like this, right? And there's that sense of adventure with the whole boat and the soundtrack, which I believe we saw in when we were looking at Deep Rising. And then there was that sense of like tension that's there as well in the surface. And then some movies go like all tension and not so much other things. And we, you know, over the past few seasons that we've looked at shark movies, it's hard to say, obviously, what makes, you know, is this a creature feature? Is this an adventure film? Is this a horror? You know, like what do you categorize this in? But I think that's the best part about it is that you can't really categorize it in one thing. It's so many different elements that work, and then you put it together. And I mean, arguably, like, you know, Steven Spielberg has a super long filmography. So, and amongst all the great things he's done over the years, there are a few standouts, and Jaws is definitely one of those where he really had everything in place. And, you know, or as you know, you always say that there's a lot of things that didn't work, but it all worked to his favor, basically.
It seems to be a very Spielberg thing. They even went for things that would like normally kill movies seem to always work in Spielberg's favor. Certainly was the case in this film. I mean, they're shooting the film over in Martha's Vineyard, which is over in Massachusetts. It's basically a stand-in for Long Island. And basically it's known, the area as well, is it's pretty shallow. I mean, it only drops to around 35 feet. So you can, they had some real sort of issues with like trying to work around the fact that, you know, there's land in the distance, because Spielberg never wanted to like give the option, especially during the second half of the film where we were going hunting the shark, that, you know, they had this option of going back to land. He wanted to like constantly give us the illusion that they're in the middle of the ocean, even though they weren't. The film itself is like plagued with horrible technical issues. I mean, this is all practical effects, which is why it's got such presence, but they're filming 12 hours a day, but only 4 hours of the day would actually be through filming, because normally something would be breaking. The shark would sink, it would break, the boat at one point started sinking. So there's just constant issues throughout the film, and somehow Spielberg manages to like pull it all together in the way that probably only he can, to create this sort of like memorable film. And as you said already, it doesn't just fall into one category. It's not just a horror film or a creature feature. It's also a film about people, in particular this small town of Amity, where there's so many different aspects at play, which makes it such an interesting location. I mean, not only do you have Chief Sheriff Brody, who's moved in from the big city to his wife's sort of like hometown, you know, seeking for like this quiet town to raise their kids. Within the town, you've got the Mayor Murray, who's busy doing what he can to keep the tourist season open, because Amity sort of like lives and dies in its tourist season. So the fact that Brody's there churning up the waters like the shark and saying, you know, we got a shark here, we got to close the beaches. And he's like, no, we can't close the beaches because this is where all the money comes from. And when you go deeper into it, there's also like all these mafia underdealings that are mentioned more in the book. And you also have characters such as Quint, who's like this local fisherman who at the same time has been raging his own sort of war on the town, and sort of using this as his sort of like hideaway when he came out of the Navy and has spent the best part of his life destroying sharks. Essentially, he takes people out on shark expeditions and hunt sharks, and it's all about him dealing with this trauma that he suffered while he was on the USS Indianapolis, which was a boat which was sunk and its crew came under attack from sharks, and he's now the way dealing with these demons by basically destroying these creatures which terrorized him. And he's sort of like the first person to set up and sit, and like ideally the best person to like deal with this giant shark issue. But of course, the town want nothing to do with it. They just want to try and push it away, and the shark just keeps coming back, keeps preying on the locals, and it just all these different elements sort of like come together. And the fact that Spielberg changes genre constantly, just why this film I think stands out so much more than The Imitators, which just basically focused on, oh, we'll just get a bunch of like shark attacks, you know, that will give us the same thing. They just focus on the scares rather than the humanity that this film has.
Yeah. I mean, the characters itself are really interesting to watch. I mean, especially since I really love how Captain Brody... Brody? Yeah. Is it Captain?
He's police chief, but it's all the same.
Police chief, yeah. Yeah, Chief Brody. That's it. That's his name. I keep mixing it up. So Chief Brody, I really enjoy that he's this person who just moves into town. So everybody treats him like he doesn't know anything. That he's kind of over-judging the situation or being over-anxious over all these things. And at the same time, I like his kind of attitude because I love how he's scared of water, but he's on an island. And then that whole conversation about, like, how that's the case. And he's like, well, it's only an island if you look at it from the water, you know. and then, you know, you have this whole thing where him and his wife actually shows up quite a bit. And they have kind of, like, these comedic little moments where they start seeing things. Like, she starts seeing that picture of the shark biting the boat, and then... Originally, she was okay with the kids being sitting in the boat, and then suddenly she was like a whole flip. There's like these little comedic moments, and their relationship, like their relationship as a couple, is also pretty fun to watch as well. It kind of adds a little something, much like, you know, when they bring in Richard Dreyfuss's character playing the oceanographer, Hooper. Yep. And he adds a lot of, because he everybody kind of like dismisses him because he's kind of young and he seems like such a rookie and no one really takes him seriously. But at the same time, he really knows his stuff, and he's kind of like the gear, and he's kind of like the direction of where, of what they're looking for, basically. He knows what size the shark is going to be. He knows what, like, he's able to finally pin down what is really important here. But at the same time, he also doesn't want to deal with all the BS that's going on in this town as they start, you know, the authorities are trying to ignore all this.
Yeah, definitely so. I mean, when it comes to Hooper, he's, as he says himself, he's spent many years inside sharks. His whole thing is that he's this guy who's come from a very privileged upbringing, and he's used it to sort of further his family's wealth, to further his research into sharks. So the fact that there's this big, almost, should we say, like prehistoric shark roaming the waters, it's like, oh, as much as a boyhood thrill to him to like hunt this mythical shark as it is to obviously be involved in this investigation to find out what exactly is going on here. And the fact that he's like one of the few allies that Brody has in this town, because everyone else is pretty much against him. The local fishermen, when they're given the, you know, when the ransom goes out to hunt the shark, they're all just basically a bunch of yahoos, as we see in that great scene where they're all like traveling out, and you got the guy throwing dynamite in the water and stuff. There's more focused on like, on just the idea of capturing this shark rather than, you know, trying to go at it any sort of logical way. And I think with Hooper, he basically brings in the logic into the hunt. And he also gives someone a great counter, really, when we get introduced to Quint, who's obviously, Quint's out there to destroy sharks, Hooper's out there to save sharks. And you've got these meeting of different ideologies in this head-on sort of collision. And the fact that they're both such fierce sort of personalities, neither one of them would back down, and yet somehow over the course of this hunt, they managed to find this common ground as we find them drinking to each other's scars that they've suffered from the ocean and their various misadventures. While Brody, like, looks on and you see him, like, finger the gun wound from his which basically retired him from New York and moved him out to Amity. So it's every single character in this film like plays their part. I mean, like from Brody's wife, even like the kids have their sort of play in it. They're not just there to get into stupid situations. Like we have that super charming scene where Brody's youngest son's copying his dad's movement to the table, and it's just bringing this humanity to the film, which we don't see in creature features normally. They're just more focused on creating big set pieces and shocks and you know, creating a sense of place. And I think this is what Spielberg brings essentially to the table. He's a director who focuses on people and places rather than just event pictures like, you know, someone like Michael Bay does.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there's no doubt, you know, that Steven Spielberg is a lot of, you know, he is the director, so he gets a lot of credit for how this movie is pieced together. But I, you know, like, and I think that that's the main thing is what makes this so successful is that you know, it's a lot of things that creature features aren't, and that's why I think it's hard to call this a creature feature. Because for a creature feature, the shark doesn't really show up that often. It's more about, like, the, you know, how this town is dealing with this whole situation. And I think that's where the forte is. Obviously, you know, the last scene is a lot about hunting the shark and how powerful it is. Like, it can drag down barrels of those flotation barrel type of things. And it shows it in these little moments. You get to see a lot of just how, like, how big this threat is without actually seeing it. And I think that that's one of the really great moments, because, you know, obviously it's a plastic shark. There's nothing really, it's like when the shark shows up, you don't really feel like he's going to be that much of a threat. And I think that, you know, a lot of it is in the tension of it, just, you know, like a creature underwater from their perspective looking at you, you know, and it's a, you know, and it creates that tension because you don't really see the object of what's going on. And that's a really, obviously that's like a really strong point I personally like when it comes to like horror movies. And this is where the horror really works in sense of Jaws.
Yeah, there's certainly. I mean, did you ever read the Peter Benchley book?
No, it's awful.
So I just told you that. It's more. It's basically the book is more focused on the town and the sharks, this background threat. I mean, Brody's wife goes off with Hooper at one point. There's a whole affair sequence which is cut from this film, thankfully. And it's. Well, obviously, Peter Benchley came on to work on the script as well. The fact that Spielberg went his own direction with the screenplay, I think it only works to the film's advantage. Much less they got a much better, they got that now iconic poster of like the shark coming up and the girl swimming, which was it's a reworking of the original cover of the book, but the shark looked like a giant sperm rather than a shark. It's really quite unfortunate. But and you can't actually do those sorts of posters anymore. You can't show women in peril on posters. Which is an interesting piece of censorship. But yeah, it's with this film again, I mean, it's, I just kind of keep going back to it. I mean, you know, this is just like, feels like such a place. And I mean, you mentioned already, I mean, the fact we don't see the shark really until a good, oh, I don't know, a good hour into the film, should we say, give or take. We should imagine, like, saying to, like, modern audiences, it's all like, oh, we got this monster, but you're not going to see it for an hour. I just wonder if there's any sort of directors that would be able to pull off what happened to it. And a lot of this, again, is just due to the fact that Sharp was hardly working. Spielberg was, like, often referred to as the Great White Turd. He named the shark Bruce after his lawyer. So there's scenes as well where they were recut because they were just like he wasn't very unhappy with. They were sort of looking, and I think all these little things just really sort of added to the film, so that when we get the big scene of like the shark popping up when Broly's there shoveling the chum, and he does that iconic "Oh, I need a bigger boat" line, this has so much impact. It's sort of like you think you have an idea what you're going after, and then you see the size of this shark's head come up, and you're like, "Oh, this is we're perhaps a little unprepared for this." So I love that. And even though we do get like a couple of shots, like when it goes into the pond, we get that wonderful long shot of the shark where you got the hippie chick who sees it going into the pond and starts like shouting "shark." I love those shots, and even the one where it's coming up under the guy underneath when they're in the pond sequence. I think those ones are great. But it's just, even though we get these little glimpses, just that shark shot of it coming up behind Brody is just has such payoff to it. But with the I mean, we've talked a lot about the town and the characters, but with these actual sort of shark attack sequences, I mean, what did you sort of like make of them? Because there's a lot of like teasing the audience here. I mean, we get that iconic opening shot, the Skinny Dipper being attacked by the shark at the beginning, and it's all lots of thrashing around and stuff that we're not seeing a dorsal fin. We don't see nothing, but it still manages to be like this really intense little sequence. And then we have that wonderful thing which we can really only do in water horror, where after the shark's over, we get just the perfect calmness of the ocean again. It's just so eerie, that calmness. We have this moment of violence and then just perfect calm. I always find that like super effective. So what is your sort of feelings? I mean, do you have any particular sort of favorites when it comes to the attack sequences, or where do you sort of sit with them?
I don't know. I it's a weird thing, but Jaws is, I think, the most famous attack sequence is the opening scene. And then everything else feels very normal, because at this point we know there's a shark. So nothing feels particularly like effective or great. I mean, even when you're talking about the boy who gets eaten on his float and even at the end when Quint has his, you know, brush up with him. And that sort of thing. And you never really feel like, you know, when I think about it, I don't really remember a lot of shark attacks. And I think that's one of the main things of this movie, is that that's why I sometimes don't really consider it a creature feature, other than the fact that its central piece is, you know, a shark. But if it was for me, I would definitely say that the opening scene is probably what really delivers if you're talking about a shark attack. And it's exactly for what you were saying, like the calm that they show afterwards. You know, you have that whole like pushing it down and she's just like crazily yelling, and and you have this contrast of this drunk guy that's just lying there and he's completely oblivious of what's going on, and he wakes up and then, you know, and then she's not there anymore, type of thing. Don't even know what happens to him, type of thing.
Yeah, and it's so key as well to the rest of the plot. I mean, obviously Brody wants to write it up as a shark attack when they say the remains. The Mer's then got his sort of like corrupt medical professional there to like write it off as a boat. That she's been hit by a boat propeller, and he's like basically says to it, sort of like, you know, we write this off as a boat accident and, you know, we're fine. But you say shark and that's going to really trigger people. And we also get that like iconic shot of her remains on the beach, which is actually a female member of the crew that they buried in the sand, because Spielberg was unhappy with the fake arm they had. So he just buried a crew member in the sand and had her lie there being covered with crabs. Which I guess is why it looks so realistic, I guess.
Must have been thrilled to do that part.
It's like my big break. I'm Chrissy's arm and Jaws. Yeah, the kid on the Lilo was actually a much more bloodier sequence when they originally shot it. Because the kid who plays him, Jeffrey Voorhees, he was a local kid, and basically they hired him and they hired all his friends to come and play swimmers and stuff on the beach, but they could never get like the shark, because it was originally going to like show the shark really sort of chomping down on him, and there is some really blurry footage of this sort of sequence there, but they could just really weren't sort of happy with the way it sort of looked. And I think the way it's shot instead, where we get that zoom in on Brody's face, that like where his like worst fear is now being realized, while at the same time you get to see the kid being dragged under, we get a little glimpse of the shark. I think it's just it's a scene only made all the more spectacular by the fact we get that huge plume of blood like come up, which is what I remembered like from the first time I watched this movie. I didn't really remember the girl being attacked to the front, but I sure remember that kid on the Lilo biting it. The kid who actually played him, as I said, Jeffrey Voorhees, he would actually open a seafood restaurant. And on the menu, they had an Alex Kinter sandwich. Now, the actress who plays his mother, Lee Ferreira, walked into the restaurant and like commented the fact that she played the mother in the film when she saw that they had an Alex Kinter sandwich. And he like came out of the back and he was sort of like, I was Alex Kinter. You played your son in this movie. And the fact they hadn't seen each other for like years since the shooting, it was just a beautiful reunion over a sandwich. So... the prop shark itself is actually hung up in a seafood restaurant at the moment, the one that they used to the Disneyland ride.
Okay.
Yeah, when they shut it down to put, I don't know, Harry Potter or something in there, the actual shark from the ride is now hanging in a seafood restaurant somewhere. Now, with the score, it's obviously got the John Williams iconic score. Spielberg originally thought it was a joke and they wouldn't work, and then when they put it onto film and saw how audiences reacted, he had to apologize to Williams and say he was wrong. Well, Williams got a great jump start to his career, because he was obviously going to like do Star Wars and like so many many like iconic themes that you wouldn't think that again a little shark movie would be the movie that not only launched the summer blockbuster but also gave Joe Williams his big break. So.
But yeah, no, I mean, the score is definitely iconic. There's nothing like, you know, two notes you never really consider this to be this, how simplistic it is to create the tension that it is, obviously. I mean, the score is obviously much more than that. It blends really into the film itself. I always think that it's such a, it's just so iconic that people don't really, like, even if you haven't seen the movie, you would have heard it.
Yeah.
And you would still know what it is.
It's still part of the, like, pop culture lexicon. It's like, you know, when you say Stepford Wives, or, and you hear that music and you just know something ominous is creeping up on you. And the fact that it's like the heartbeat that plays in the background in Alien, or it just has this sort of presence to it. It's sort of like, it's giving the shark presence on the screen, even when we're just in like shark POV mode. We're sort of like moving through the ocean, and we just know that the more intense the music's getting, the closer the shark's getting, and it's one of those just an iconic piece of music. It's like the Halloween score. It just sticks with you, and even just like doing if you just like hummed a couple of notes, you're like bah, bum. And then people like instantly know, it's like, oh, that's the Jaws movie. So I still love the score to this one, and certainly when you get into the many of the scenes in the film, just like how complex the score is, how it like perfectly matches certain moments, such as like when Brody's there like drunk and defeated, and he's just there like drinking at his table, or when we're hunting the shark and it goes into that almost like adventure sort of like rift.
Yeah.
When they're pursuing the shark, and we forget, oh, we're not in a horror movie, we're now in an adventure movie. We're like following these three guys on this like adventure to go and hunt the big shark. So, and I think it's the willingness to change genres on the fly like that is why this film sort of stands out more than many of the imitators did. I mean, there are, not to say there's not been films that have come close or even matched it, but because it's just, and this is the point we keep returning to, it's just, it's so much more than just one thing. I think that's why that's why it's so effective, and certainly with the score, it only further emphasizes these moments as well, along with just like some really fantastic performances throughout.
Yeah, and you make a really good point, because when we look at blockbusters nowadays, a lot of them are fairly one tone, in the sense that you either, you know, maybe you have like two genres together, yeah, or something, like, you know, horror thrillers or whatever, or action, you know, action comedy or whatever, I don't know. Just off the top of my head. But those aren't, like, blockbuster themes, I guess. Or, like, dramedies or something like that, right? But when you look at, you know, and then you look at movies nowadays as to why there's not as many films that kind of reach that same caliber as Jaws, using creatures in general. And I think that's one of the main contributions. I mean, is the fact that, you know, you can change genres constantly. And I think... this kind of leads me to why I really enjoy the liberty that indie films have nowadays, because indie films, you see a lot more of these really mixed genres combined together. Obviously, you know, creature features, low budget isn't really in the horizon, so you don't really see a lot of creature features in kind of like limited budget, but I mean, I think that's a very, very good point, in the sense that why blockbusters now don't quite have the same type of appeal, especially when it comes to making, you know, kind of like a Predator and Prey, you know, type of film like that.
Yeah. Now until we see the final sort of hunt here, where we got, you know, one Quint's boat, the Orca, and we're following like Brody and Hooper, and the fact that, I mean, Brody obviously has no experience on boats. He's in there with like the rag there because he's getting seasick, and the fact that Hooper and Quint are both boat people, so they've got they know how to like tie a sheep shank, and they know what they're doing on boats, and Brody's basically lost any idea of standing, because I mean, he's so used to having some level of respect because he's the police chief, and here on the boat he's like basically the bottom rung of this ladder. The fact he's also dealing with clashing egos of Quint, who's basically, well, it's his boat, he's going to do everything his own way, and then you got Hooper is like trying to do things like the scientific way, and then you've got obviously Brody, who's caught in the middle of this this clash of egos, and somehow over the course of the film, the three manage to find this sort of common ground to them before it all falls apart rather rapidly. With Quint essentially going full Ahab, he gets sees his opportunity to capture this big shark, and is becomes completely zoned in on this idea of dragging this shark into the shallows and drowning it, and at the same time we've also got Hooper, who's basically trying to do what they can to use what resources they have to try and stop this shark. And we have the moment where he goes in the shark cage and then goes and hides behind a sand dune, because he's real hero material like that. In the original book, he actually gets eaten by the shark when he goes in the cage. With this trio of characters, I mean, how did you find this clashing of ideologies that really sort of makes up the final part of this film? It's certainly not the direction you would expect a creature feature to go, but especially because it takes moments to slow down the pace and take times to really sort of get to know these characters about all the other interesting things happening in the town, like the Karate Kids karateing the fences, and these other sort of minor characters that provide all the local colour. By putting Monty Orca, we're essentially just stripping it all away just to these three characters.
But I think that's because these three characters are so core, right? They have so much power in their characters themselves. They each are authorities kind of in their own field. So you kind of have a power struggle at the same time as having them being able to talk a little bit more about themselves and giving, especially, you know, when we come to Quint, who talks about, you know, the USS Indianapolis and what happens to him there and what essentially leads him to doing this. Because from the beginning, we just think he's some, you know, crazy fisherman who is very, very cocky and really believes that, you know, he's the only person that's going to be able to bag this shark. And he's going to charge you a hefty fee just to do it. And you never really see a lot of what he's capable of doing. And the same goes for Hooper, but where, you know, he has his own expertise and he's able to do, you know, the whole autopsy element of it and really understand, like, the theory behind it more than the actual, I guess, the actual thing. But you have these two points that kind of meet together, and then you have this Brody who is essentially shoved into this situation where he's scared of drowning, he hates boats, he hates water. All these things, you know, the three characters kind of represent different parts of stance on these things. And that's what makes it interesting when they finally, you know, at one point when they're drinking, they finally unite. And despite the uniting, obviously, they still have their differences when things go haywire, right? But you know, it's interesting to see how these characters are developed, because I think that the last scene really gives a lot of space for Quint's character to grow. And it's in all in due time, obviously, because he really, it kind of explains a lot of his, like, crazy attitude towards this and how he's really hooked up on, you know, fighting the shark.
Yeah, of course. I mean, with Quint, I mean, he's basically he's a hired gun, essentially. At the same time, he drops his services. Well, no, sorry. He takes advantage of the situation, the fact that the town have done, basically just made the situation worse with the shark. Because originally he offers to kill the shark for 3,000. By the time the town comes crawling back to him, he's upped his price to 10,000. So he knows very much that he's the guy who's going to get the job done. And there's a lot of smaller details when you certainly look at his character in the book. I mean, the fact that he's had numerous run-ins with the mayor's office because of where his sort of fishing shack is built, and the fact that he basically uses all this, like, knowledge he gets from books to fight the town. So he's a constant thorn in the side that they can't get rid of him. But at the same time, he's got nowhere else to really go. I mean, his whole business is just doing shark tours and making moonshine. And this is how he subsidizes his living. Then when it came to obviously cast him, I mean, obviously Robert Shaw is cast here with just a truly iconic performance. At the same time, it's been said that, it's certainly been said by Roy Scheider, who said that working with Robert Shaw, because he was an alcoholic, he was like working with Jekyll and Hyde, that when he wasn't drinking, he was a perfect gentleman, but when he had a drink in him, he was a mean son of a bitch. And the scene where he's like supposed to do the Indianapolis speech, he was supposed to originally do it intoxicated, but all the shots they tried to do it when he was drinking it, they just couldn't get it done. And basically Shaw like came back to him, he was like really upset over his performance, and he said to Spielberg, let me do it sober. And he did it completely right the first time, and he did it in one take, and it's now this iconic monologue of just this man basically giving us an insight into what makes him tick, basically. This idea that, you know, he was once this, like, Brody, and Hooper is this idol, this person who's just obviously been corrupted by this horrific event that happened to him when he was sort of based to spend all these hours in the water waiting to be rescued while sharks were basically trying to attack him and the crew of his ship. This is something when I see Robert Shaw's character, when I see his character in this film, it's just, I can't really see anyone else doing the role as well as he did. I mean, they obviously talked to Lee Marvin, who said that he'd prefer to fish for real than to be play a fisherman in the film. They also consisted casting a local fisherman called Craig Kingsbury, who actually had a role. He turns up as Ben Garner, who's probably best known for giving us the best jump scare of the movie that still bloody gets me every time, when his decapitated head pees peekaboo. I've seen this movie so many times, and every bloody time that head gets me, I feel my head is like, oh, it's coming now. I'm just like, nope. As soon as I've like misjudged it, it then appears. And that is probably one of the most tweaked scenes of the film. Spielberg said that, you know, when they originally showed test screenings for the film, they had like the big reaction to the shark coming out of the water, and then he was like, oh, I'm sure I could get another jump here, and they did the head, and he kept tweaking it to like maximize the effect, and he was like judging on how high the popcorn was flying each time he showed it to people. So, but I mean, this is just Spielberg, isn't it? It's just a maestro at work, just constantly tweaking details that no other filmmakers probably wouldn't think about, just to work a small jump scare into something truly memorable. So, but the final sort of showdown with the shark, which basically comes down to Brody on a rapidly sinking boat. I mean, how did you find like this idea of the shark that's just like slowly destroying a boat, and how it like just how the whole sort of attack sequence plays out, the big finale? How did that sit with yourself, Kim?
I think it was pretty good. I mean, it's because, you know, whenever we have these big moments in creature features, it's always kind of represents the same type of thing. And this is probably the part where we're most in that creature feature zone, because the shark at this point is relentless. He, you know, when they're doing all the singing and everything, and they're finally united, it starts crashing through the boat, which makes the boat leak eventually. And then at one point, you know, you basically, it's just kind of, the boat is just breaking apart at this point. The shark cage goes and things fall apart. And it all kind of like comes together really quickly, where as the boat is sinking, the shark is starting to attack into the boat now, where they're kind of taking refuge. And I think it's nice, because it's a really fun scene, because now, you know, the danger is there. The actual shark is there, and he's just coming for you. And you can see how they're fighting against it. And at the same time, in the back of your mind, you're kind of thinking about, oh, well, when is Hooper going to show up? Because, you know, he survived. He's in the back of there somewhere. He's hiding underwater somewhere. But when is he going to pop up, you know? And he essentially doesn't, because until the very end. And it all of a sudden it ends up that Brody, the man who is deathly scared of water, is suddenly thrust into this position where he has to figure out how to fight the shark. And it's really fun, because, you know, he uses all the resources he can, and then he's just trying to blow him up, basically.
Well, yeah, I mean, the fact he gets blown up by an exploding air lung's really sort of like it's kind of a little coincidental, it has to be said. Yes. In the original book, the shark I'd say the shark dies of old age, but it's supposed to, like, die from its wounds, because we have this scene where, like, the shark's coming up on the boat, and Brody's there, like, staring it down, and then it, like, just keels over and dies. So it's a little weird when you read it, and it's a passage I had to like go back and read a couple of times. It's like, just makes sense. It's sort of like the shark just died. Okay.
Very exciting.
It's sort of like he just stares that shark down, and it just keeled over in pure fright. But Peter Benchley hated the ending that Spielberg gave the movie, and I'm thinking, well, your ending wasn't much better. So. And I like, it's funny, like, there's little bits of the film, like, when they're going along the side of the boat, and you see, like, his deck shoe slip on the side of the boat. That fills me with such tension when I see it. It's like, oh, he's going to fall in the water, or the shark's going to leap up or something. But it's when it's like the shark's like, the boat's like going fully underwater, and it's like busting through the side, and you know the last place Brody wants to be is in the water, and he's just like desperately trying to like do what he can to stay in the water. And then when he's up on the rigging, and it slowly starts sinking as the shark's honing in on him, as he's just like stares it down, this like one final stand. It's just fantastic filmmaking. And my dad said that when he saw the Jaws when it was in the cinema, and said that when the shark blew up, everyone in the audience cheered. And when I years later we would go to see Independence Day, and when they blow up the big ship in at the end of Independence Day, the same thing happened. The audience cheered. And I was like, oh, we finally had our Jaws moment.
Although, I mean, I'm guessing a lot of people would have a really long discussion with you if you're comparing Jaws to Independence.
I'm talking about just like the climactic thing. I mean, it's this big moment where we beat it down with the string. We finally defeat it.
Yeah.
Maybe, I don't know, maybe it's just this big explosion that everyone just went to cheer. I was when I saw The Raid, and you see like the 2-on-1 fight at the finale of that movie. People actually cheered at the end of that one as well. It's all, and I was like, just like looking around going, when you've seen a fight of that skill, it's all you can do is just cheer the screen, I guess.
Well, I mean, that I feel like Raid is a completely different experience as well, because it is like one man going through an entire building, right? So you have everything against him, and then at the end when he finally makes it, you can't help but to feel a little like, you know.
He went through some stuff.
Like, it kind of deserves it.
It's just fun that, like, that as the audience, when you have, when the cinema and the audience has, like, that shared reaction to something. We don't really get it now in modern cinema. I don't think people, audiences, are just so distracted, or we're just not getting those sort of same sort of payoffs.
I really feel like it's just like, you know, modern cinema, and like the general cinema is like that. And that's one of the things that I really enjoy about, you know, being on location for film festivals, which is obviously something that hasn't happened. I mean, I don't know when this episode goes out. Probably the pandemic will be mostly behind us at this point. But I mean, like, for the last 2 years of film festivals, basically it's all been virtual. So you kind of miss out on that effect, because I think that's what it is for film festivals, is that it's particularly fun because you have everyone reacting at the same time to this, you know, world premiere movie that no one else has ever seen, or some movie that's finally hitting the festival circuit around you, and you get to see it with a bunch of other people who are fans of movies, because those are the only people who are seeking out film festivals. And it's doubly nice because at the same time, you know, a lot of times there's the producers or the directors or the actors or something there, and they get to kind of join in with you, because it's some of these are just such early pieces that they haven't even seen the final cuts of it. So they're kind of cheering along at the same time. And it's such a really great moment when you have that. And I think that, I mean, I've never experienced this in theaters myself. Like, I don't go to old movies, reruns in theaters or anything. And I rarely go to the theater in general. So my theater visits are mostly for blockbuster movies that I really want to see. And then they usually turn out into, depending where you go, it's usually annoying people in the corner, or people playing on their phones, or, you know, or like couples kissing in the corner, or, you know, that sort of thing. And it's not, you know, like, it's one of the, you know, every time you go to the theater, it's kind of like, it turns you off a little bit more. So
it's why you got to discover the 10 a.m. showing. It's like when I was like, you know, it used to be the midnight showing was like, you know, the cool showing to go to. But now a 10 a.m. showing, there's no one in, you can get a coffee. It's just brilliant.
Oh, man. I don't know. I think I did one 10 a.m. showing once for Lord of the Rings, Return of the King. And I fell asleep.
I'm about to say, if I go normal time, it's an expensive nap.
It was like a 9 a.m. showing or something. And then I fell asleep for like 10 minutes or something. I took a power nap and I woke up and I was like, okay, we're ready. I can continue this.
True. You know, they have showings of this where, like, on lakes where, like, you get to sit in an inner tube. I can't think of anything worse than watching Jaws in an inner tube. Oh my god, that would just like that'd be traumatizing for myself. Whew. But then I don't tend to like go to like a lot of like, you know, when they have like old movies come back in the cinema, unless I've seen if I've seen it before, I don't tend to like go. It's so weird watching like a movie like Jaws or Apocalypse Now in the cinema, and you're just like instead of like a film you're so familiar with seeing at home, and then to see it on a big screen, it's such a weird experience. And also the seats normally suck in the places doing them, so it's like sitting on a wooden board for 4 hours if you're watching Apocalypse Now. I took my friend to see Apocalypse Now Redux, and it was like 4 hours, and it was like they had an intermission halfway through, and you're like so relieved you get to come off your wooden board, and then the dread that you've got another 2 hours when it comes back on still to sit through. So
just bring a cushion.
I should have brought a cushion. I should have, instead of focusing on smuggling cheese boards in there to piss off the Art House crowd. Yeah, my game of what's the weirdest snack I can smuggle into the cinema. But those cinemas are great when you want to go by yourself, because you don't have to like, if you like go to like a nice cinema, you've got to like, it's got too much sense of occasion. But if you find like a nice grimy cinema, you don't mind going by yourself. That was the theory back in the day. Now people just go to the cinema because they just can't be bothered to find people to go with, unless they're like trying to hook up or something, I guess. But anyway, so in like the big Jaws of like the shark movie pamphlet, where do you sort of rank Jaws? Is it like your favorite shark movie, or is there other shark movies you rank above it?
No, I think Jaws is really great. Like, it's hard to deny the location of like how good it is. I mean, I don't go back to rewatch Jaws as much as other people, probably because I don't own the movie.
Move to the UK, it's always on TV, so.
Yeah, well, I also don't have a TV with channels. My TV is just for streaming and casting at this point. Because, you know, I'm too cheap to.
You're just too hip. You just
to get cable.
Just one of the hip kids now, Kim. That's what they all do. They don't own TVs, they just stream everything, so.
Well, it's great because, you know, Jaws is on Amazon Prime at the time that we're recording this. So, you know, we were able to watch it on that. But, I mean, Jaws is pretty high up, I would say, in my ranking. I would probably still, I think from this whole creature feature season, we have a really good idea about where I stand on creature features. is that I like kind of something with a little bit of fun to it. Jaws does meet that. I would say like it would be pretty close to the top. Like my top movie is obviously Deep Blue Sea for both sentimental and just fun reasons. I really like it. Much like, you know, Deep Rising had that kind of same effect. And if you think about it, some of these films kind of have that tight, the kind of like brushes against that feeling that Jaws has. It's just Jaws is much more refined as a movie. You know, obviously because it's Steven Spielberg and you have all these different genres and all the things that we talked about in this past like hour or so. So no, it'd be pretty high up there. It'd be like top five, you know, when you talk about like shark movies.
Yeah.
How about you? I know you're a big fan of this.
Jaws 2 is
trumps the first one. So
on certain days, I would say Jaws 2 is better than Jaws 1. Controversial opinion, I know, but Jaws 2 is a discussion for another day because I do really love Jaws 2. The Jaws 2 had the really iconic poster of the, you get to see the sea at sunset and you've got the shark fin, and it's like just at the above the top. It says, you know, just when you thought it was safe to go back in the water. And there's another one which has got like two sharks on, which really misled because you thought you were going to have Jaws 2 is going to be like two sharks now, but it wasn't. Just one mean ass shark. I think when it came to Jaws 2 is much more of a sort of traditional creature feature. I think the closest we got to this film was Orca from 1977 with Richard Harris and Charlotte Rampling, and I believe Bo Derek's in there as well, about the fisherman who's stalked by a vengeful killer whale after he kills its pregnant mate. And I think that was the closest we got to matching what we got with Jaws. I mean, Jaws itself, let's not forget, it would go and spawn 3 sequels, as well as Bruno Mattei's unofficial Part 5 Cruel Jaws. Because Bruno Mattei is the master of the unofficial sequel. And let's not forget, I mean, it obviously led on to numerous other shark movies. I mean, you had the Italian ones, such as, like, Mako, Jaws of Death, and The Last Shark. We got a whole host of other creature features, from, like, grizzly and alligator, as we obviously covered on our creature feature season, right, which also included, like, the wonderfully bonkers Italian creature feature Wild Beasts, as directors constantly throughout the 70s tried to one up each other to see what the animals they could make the scariest. And right into the 90s, early 2000s, we've obviously Deep Blue Sea. Deep Blue Sea was a real return to form, and Lake Placid, I think, also needs to be noted as well, as really sort of capturing that ride. And then it's just been downhill ever since, because the asylum had just been churning them out once a week for God knows how many years now. So you can go off and watch, was it 6 Sharknado movies now?
I don't know.
You watch.
I watch up to, I think, 3, yeah, and then I stop.
You can watch Sharktopus and 5-Headed Shark Attack and all that nonsense. So, but Jaws will forever remain the film which sort of sparked a fascination with, like, creature features, with sharks. And sure, it misses out some of the details of the book, but at the same time, it's capturing this believable sense of a community, of a place. That Amityville just felt so real. And at the end, no matter, like, you know, her handling of the situation, I mean, it still begs the question, really, is it safe to go back in the water? Jaws, myself, still classic. No matter how many times I watch it, it's still fantastic. So that brings us to the end of tonight's episode. Thank you, as always, for listening. If you haven't done already, please do hit the like and subscribe button wherever you happen to be listening to us. And leave us a review, as it all helps raise the profile of the show. You can follow us on Facebook and Twitter and Instagram. You can also check out our blog, which is smoothcitypodcast.wordpress.com, for our full archive of episodes, as well as other fun pieces of writing, including our Friday Film Club, where every Friday, myself and Kim both pick a film to highlight. Sometimes there's a theme, sometimes there's not, but either way, it's a chance to talk about more of the films we love. But what have we got next, Kim, as we continue our After Hours season?
Yeah, well, next time we're going to be talking about your pick, which is 99's Virus. And I don't know why I'm talking about it, because, you know, I know nothing about it. So
yep, we're talking about Virus from the greatest movie year ever, in a film that Jamie Lee Curtis absolutely hates, as a group of salvage engineers stumble across an abandoned Russian battleship. But an alien entity has taken control of the ship. Make sure you check us that out next week as we check out Virus. Is it as bad as Jim Lee Curtis thinks, or is it a lost gem? We will certainly find out next week when Kim watches it for the first time. So make sure you join us for that. But until then, thank you as always for listening. Thank you to my co-host Kim. And we'll be back next time to talk about Virus. Until then, good night.